This was a fighting force that could go only one way, and Sebastian and his excuse for a defending force were directly in their path. He got on the phone. Chang, what are you doing this instant?
You don't want to know.
Of course I do.
I'm lying on my back, watching the clouds.
And you're not alone, are you?
Of course not, Chang said.
Priscilla and I are going to be apart when Jesus comes, Sebastian said.
You want me to send her and Beth Ann to be with you?
Hardly. We've arranged a meeting spot for when this is over.
I hope Captain Steele will be up to watching all this when he gets here and the time comes, Chang said.
Oh, he will be. Just hope the time doesn't come before Razor gets him there. As you know, Enoch told his people, the whole theme through my teaching of the events of the end times has been the mercy of God. To many of you, this seemed inconsistent with what was prophesied and what came to pass. But as I have said, all of this, all 21 judgments that have come from heaven in 3 sets of 7, have been God's desperate last attempts to get man's attention. Make no mistake about it, however, the last 7 judgments in particular also evidence his wrath. In fact, the angels who carry out these judgments are depicted as turning over and emptying out bowls or vials so that every drop of judgment is poured out on the various targets of God's anger. Notice the focus of these judgments. The first bowl was poured out on the earth in the form of horrible, malignant sores on the bodies of those who had taken the mark of the beast. The second was poured out into the sea, turning the water to blood and killing every living thing in it. The third was poured into the rivers and springs, so that all remaining fresh water was turned to blood. You'll recall that this was God's initial and partial response to the martyrs' prayers in Revelation 6, verse 10, that their deaths be avenged. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? The fourth bowl was poured out on the sun so that it so increased in power that extraordinary heat burned men with fire. And how did those who survive respond? Revelation 16, verse 9, tells us they blasphemed the name of God who has power over these plagues, and they did not repent and give him glory. The fifth bowl was poured out on the throne of the beast. Who knows what that means?
New Babylon!
Yes. And we know that mighty city was plunged into a darkness so great that it caused physical pain so severe that men and women gnawed their own tongues. And once again, what was their response? They blasphemed the God of heaven because of their pains and their sores, and did not repent of their deeds. The sixth bowl was poured out on the great river, the Euphrates, and it dried up. That allowed the leaders from the east to bring their armies to the mountains of Israel for the battle of Armageddon. Here God was clearly luring Antichrist into his trap. Joel 3, verses 9 to 17 prophesies this, and though scholars disagree about when the book of Joel was written, it is generally agreed that it was more than 800 years before Christ. Proclaim this among the nations. Prepare for war. Wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong. Assemble and come, all you nations, and gather together all around. Cause your mighty ones to go down there, O Lord. Let the nations be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, go down,
For the wine press is full, the vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and moon will grow dark, and the stars will diminish their brightness. The Lord also will roar from Zion, and utter his voice from Jerusalem. The heavens and earth will shake, but the Lord will be a shelter for his people, and the strength of the children of Israel. So you shall know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Then Jerusalem shall be holy, and no aliens shall ever pass through her again. Enoch continued. The seventh bowl judgment, the one we still await, will be poured out upon the air, so that lightning and thunder and other celestial calamities announce the greatest earthquake in history. It will be so great it will cause Jerusalem to break into three pieces in preparation for changes during Christ's millennial kingdom. It will also be accompanied by a great outpouring of 100-pound hailstones. And what will the general response be from the very ones God is trying to reach and persuade? Revelation 16, verse 21 tells us that men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, since that plague was exceedingly great. And this is what's coming next? Someone said. In advance of the glorious appearing, Enoch said. Yes. And you believe this? Without question. Then what are we doing outside while the clouds gather? Do you not recall that believers have been spared injury under all these judgments? I rest in that. Amen! Praise the Lord! Come, Lord Jesus! I rest in something else, beloved, Enoch said. One of the most beautiful and reassuring passages in Scripture is John 14, verses 1 to 6, where Jesus is comforting his disciples. I believe we can take these promises for ourselves and stand secure, knowing they were made by one in whom there is no change, neither shadow of turning. Let me read them to you. Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you, and if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also, and where I go, you know, and the way you know. Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you are going, and how can we know the way? Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Rayford noticed a lull in the activity and assumed it was because both Razor and Leah needed Abdullah's help to load him aboard the big ATV. And Abdullah was 15 or so feet down the rocky slope with his back to them on the phone. When it appeared he was finished, he called someone else. The energy bar, distasteful as it was, had its desired effect, and Rayford was ready to get going. He'd felt better in his day, but despite numerous ailments, he had a renewed sense of purpose and drive. Let's go, he thought, but he said nothing. Presently, Abdullah returned. Many people worry about you, Captain, he said. Re-Wu, for one, but especially Chaim himself. He wonders what your plans are. My plans? To keep breathing, to survive the trip. He's wondering if you would be up to his visit at your quarters when you arrive. Of course, Rayford said. Know what he wants? Again, Leah said, let's not get ahead of ourselves, shall we? You joke about surviving the trip, and frankly, I'm quite worried about that. You have no idea how you'll feel when you arrive. You likely have a broken rib on top of everything else, maybe more than one. It's nearly impossible to tell without an X-ray or MRI.
What are you saying, Doc?
I'm just a nurse, but moving you the way we're planning is just about the worst possible scenario for you right now.
Just about.
Staying here would be worse, but at least you're stable.
Mac gingerly climbed aboard the biggest, blackest, most powerful horse he had ever seen. It had been years, but he knew enough to plant his left foot firmly in the stirrup before swinging his right leg up and over. If anyone was looking, he might appear to have a clue. Unfortunately, he was more concerned with mounting than he was with his dangling Uzi, and before he settled firmly in the saddle, the barrel of his weapon poked the horse in the back, just above the saddle horn at the base of the neck. The beast started and stepped about quickly, causing Mac to panic and stiffen. That made the horse rear. Mac pulled on the reins with all his weight, desperate to hang on and not be chucked off onto his head. As the steed whinnied loudly and reared higher, spooking other horses and riders, Mac slid out of the saddle and the stirrup slackened. Mac pushed his legs straight as hard as he could, tucked his chin to his chest, and held the reins for all he was worth. That pulled the horse's muzzle down and nearly made him topple backward. Mac was almost upside down, all his weight pulling against the horse, and he could imagine pulling the animal down atop him. Somehow the horse balanced itself with a few well-placed steps with its back feet, then slammed down to all fours, thrusting Mac hard into the saddle and throwing him forward to where he was now hugging it around the neck. The animal still felt unsure beneath him, and Mac knew he had done the opposite of showing it who was in charge. If a message had been sent to the horse, it was that the rider was scared to death and hanging on for dear life. Mac's superior appeared not to have noticed. He cantered up and pointed to several soldiers, Mac included, directing them to position themselves off the flanks of Carpathia's horse. Leave it to the potentate to have a monster creature that put the rest to shame. His horse was at least 2 hands taller and 100 pounds heavier than the others. It had a spot of white between its eyes and 4 white feet. Its tail seemed to shoot straight up before the rest of it cascaded down in a smart flow. The mane was somehow longer and thicker as well. Mac had heard of the Hound of Heaven. This was the horse from hell. It even seemed to have attitude. It snuffled loudly whenever another horse invaded its space, and it nipped and kicked to keep its place. Carpathia appeared to have been raised around horses, deftly controlling the thing with a light grip and decisive hands, knees, and feet. He rode ahead several feet and turned his horse to face the others.
"Let me remind you all," he said, "that we are merely feet from an active battleground. The resistance currently holds the Temple Mount above ground, and they are capable of firing from atop the wall. Be vigilant. This is not a press junket or a sightseer's safari. I am most disappointed to tell you that I have just been made aware of an insurgence within our own ranks from both the south in Egypt and below, and from the northeast. Ironically, some who pledged their allegiance now call themselves Revitalized Babylon and condescend to assert their independence. These uprisings shall be crushed post-haste. As we speak, portions of our more than extravagantly outfitted fighting force will peel off to these locations to lay waste to the pretenders. They will regret their insolence only as long as they have breath, and then they will be trampled and made an example of. Meanwhile, we will figuratively set out for Petra. I say figuratively, because I do not plan to waste the hours it would take to actually ride some 60 miles on horseback. The global community media will get what it needs as we strike out from here, leave the occupied Muslim quarter and head southwest through the Jewish and Armenian quarters, both also having been easily taken by our forces, and leave the old city through the Zion Gate.
There you will transfer to ground vehicles capable of covering the distance at well over 100 miles an hour. I will set out a few minutes later with my generals and cabinet in aircraft that will actually transport us and our horses to the area slightly in advance of your arrival. We have mounts similar to those you are on now waiting for you outside Petra, and you shall have the privilege of witnessing my leading our troops to victory over what shall by then be one of only 2 remaining enclaves of opposition to the New World Order. Smile for the cameras. Mac finally felt he had control of his horse, but he had no intention of following Carpathia in one of the ground vehicles. If any portion of the security detail was assigned elsewhere, Mac would find a way to join them and then peel off to his own helicopter. He wouldn't mind seeing what went down at Petra, though he had been taught that the actual fighting would take place 20 miles north in Busaira, Jordan, the modern name of the city of Basra, ancient capital of Edom, when Messiah chased the Unity Army back toward Jerusalem. Besides the dizziness that came with trying to stand for the first time in hours, Rayford found himself wholly dependent upon the small but wiry Abdullah Smith and the broader, stronger, and younger Razor. Leah had brought everything, it seemed, but crutches. She did her bit to help, too, but she couldn't support him and mainly directed traffic, trying to keep his most vulnerable injuries isolated. Rayford could put 0 weight on the broken shin bone, splint or not. Hopping was out of the question, so the 2 men had to bear all his weight as they moved him to the ATV. Even his good foot touching the ground occasionally sent shockwaves of pain throughout the rest of his body. The anesthetic in his temple was wearing off, and Leah had decided not to add more. Straddling the ATV was a delicate operation. Leah rolled up a towel and bunched it under the knee of his broken leg in an attempt to keep his foot from touching the vehicle. That left him able to balance himself only with his good foot and leg, plus his painful arms latched tightly to Razor's waist. Rayford dreaded what he knew was coming. At some point, his weight would shift to the broken shinbone side, and he would either have to wrestle Razor the other way or plant that foot to keep from flying off the ATV. Once he was in place, Leah insisted he just sit there and get his bearings. "You okay?" she said. "Think so," he said, already exhausted. He shut his eyes and rolled his neck, hearing it pop and crack. Then he stole a look at the sky. Clouds covered half the visible canopy now, and they were beginning to roil in all different colors. The sun was half below the horizon, wide and flat, and at its most burnt orange, painting the clouds in pinks and reds and yellows. Were he not fearing for his life, he'd have thought it one of the most beautiful skies he had ever seen. Leah had final instructions for Razor. "I'll lead the way," she said. "Mr. Smith will follow you should we have a problem and need to lift Captain Steele again. My machine has a lot of weight on it, too, so if I can make it through a certain area, you should be able to as well. I'll be trying to avoid ruts, bumps, even the smallest rocks, but of course we can't avoid them all. Try to take the steep areas as slowly as possible, but you'll need some power and momentum. Rayford, you'll just have to hang on and grit your teeth. The first 50 yards or so are pretty clear, so I'll try to keep an eye behind me to make sure you're both doing okay." Rayford had always considered himself a man's man. 6'4" and thickly muscled, he had played sports through pain of all sorts, and since the rapture, he'd endured his share of serious injuries. But as he sat there, vice-gripping Razor's belt, he wanted to scream like a baby. Everything hurt. It was as if the pain had a life and mind of its own and threatened to kill him itself. It dug deep, mostly in his temple and shin, and it vibrated, throbbed, prodded. When Razor so much as fired up the engine, the hum alone flashed through Rayford's body and made him instantly lightheaded. Razor would likely be able to tell if he passed out, just from the change in his grip, But Rayford was determined to gut this out. Leah slowly pulled ahead, the pair of coolers hanging off the sides of her ATV like mismatched saddlebags. Razor turned his head.
"Just say the word and I stop."
"Go," Rayford managed, and the four-wheeler began rolling. Lord have mercy.
"Okay," Razor called back.
"Don't ask, son. I'll let you know. You just keep moving."
Sebastian was struck by the grandeur of the early evening sun casting its glow over the black-clad enemy. Who'd have thought this evil mass of humanity could be seen in an attractive light? He had been joined by Otto Weser, the German who had maintained a small band of believers inside New Babylon until nearly the end.
"Ever dream you'd have this privilege, Otto?"
"Privilege? This is my definition of the awesome and terrible day of the Lord.
But to be standing here, facing Antichrist's army on the last day of the earth as we know it, I'd rather have acted on the truth when I had the chance and be in heaven already, if you want complete honesty."
"Well, of course," Sebastian said. "But given that we missed it, there's no place I'd rather be right now. I just wish my wife and daughter could be with me."
"You wouldn't want them out here," Otto said, the understatement so obvious that Sebastian couldn't think of a retort. "You're not bothered by an enemy close enough to look up our nostrils?"
Sebastian shook his head. "If they wanted to kill us, and God allowed it, it would have happened long ago. I've been in aircraft that missiles had no business missing. I feel invulnerable standing here. I can't beat this army, I know that, not on my own. But Dr. Ben-Judah and Dr. Rosenzweig and lots of other teachers have me convinced that this whole fighting force is going to make like the Midianites before Gideon and turn tail and run by the time this night is out. I can't wait to see that.
It's a little hard to believe, though, isn't it? I mean, looking at their sheer numbers."
Sebastian turned and studied the older man in the twilight. "God changed a cloudless day into a cloudy one a little while ago. And you watched while the entire city of New Babylon was laid to ruins in the space of 60 minutes. And you say something's hard to believe."
Rayford hated it most when Leah stopped and Razor had to do the same. There was no smooth way to do that, not on these inclines. Sometimes Razor was forced to stop without having found a flat place. There, Ray sat, hanging on tight to keep from slipping off the back of the ATV.
"This is where the going gets tough," Leah said.
"And the tough get going," Rayford thought. "What do you call what we've been doing so far?" he said.
"Easy Street," she said. "From here on out, we can't stop. We can barely slow down. We're going up steep angles, and we need to keep moving. You just have to gut it out. Let's go."
She took off faster than Rayford had thought possible or prudent, and while Razor eased into his speed a bit more carefully, he was soon gunning the engine to make the grade. A couple of sharp turns made Rayford cry out, but when Razor backed off the throttle, Rayford assured him with a shout that he was okay. Soon they hit the steepest climb, and Rayford felt as if he were hanging upside down. He scanned the area around him and realized if he lost his grip here, he would be in serious trouble. He would tumble farther than he had initially. Abdullah's bike whined up beside them, and he flashed a thumbs up. Rayford shook his head. All he needed was to yield to the temptation to let go with one hand and return the gesture, and he'd be a dead man. He rested his forehead in the middle of Razor's back. Where did these kids get the steel muscles today? In his prime, Rayford was never cut like this specimen. The sun was fast fading, and all three vehicles' automatic lights came on at the same time. They finally rounded a curve that put them on an actual path, and Rayford realized the rest of the way would be relatively easy. What he was not prepared for, however, was the welcome he received.
Tens of thousands of residents were out gathering the evening manna and watching the heavens. Word must have passed far and wide about his predicament, because everyone seemed to know the makeshift motorcade was his transport home. People waved and shouted and whistled and raised their hands. He couldn't acknowledge them except to nod. Meanwhile, Smitty was waving as if it were his own ticker tape parade. Rayford could only imagine the welcome Jesus would receive. Chapter 7. The sun had dipped below the horizon, leaving a bright, nearly full moon to illuminate an otherwise inky, cloud-scattered sky. The cloud colors had seemed to change in an instant, pastels giving way to deep blues, purples, lavenders, and traces of a fast-fading burnt orange. Abdullah, Reza, and Leah helped Rayford to his quarters. He insisted on waiting uncomfortably in a side chair while they moved his bed to face the open window. That way, on his back, he could take in the entire vista of the beautiful night sky. Something was brewing, and, of course, he knew what it was. Razor appeared eager to get back to his post and was quickly gone. Leah said she would be close by in the infirmary and that either she or Hannah would be available at a moment's notice with just a call. Abdullah said he was worried about Mac, then looked as if he shouldn't have said anything. "Where is Mac, Smitty?" Rayford said. Abdullah told him. "If anything's happened to Buck," Rayford said, "I don't want Kenny knowing, and I don't want him to see me this way. Can you confirm Kenny's still with Priscilla Sebastian?" Abdullah got on the phone, updated Priscilla on Rayford, and nodded to Ray. "Kenny is about to go to sleep for the night," he said. "That'll be one to tell his grandchildren," Ray said. "I slept through the glorious appearing." Rayford was grateful to be off the four-wheeler and in his own bed, but he hadn't realized how much the day had taken out of him until he was lying flat. "I may sleep through it myself," he said. "Would you keep me company, Smitty? Keep me awake?" The Jordanian looked ill at ease. He had never been one for confrontation, and it was obvious he didn't want to accede to Rayford's request. "Hey, it's all right, man," Rayford said. "You've got stuff to do, places you need to be." "It's not that, Captain, but Dr. Rosenzweig is due soon." "Oh, that's right. And yes, I would like to be in the air when all these things come to pass. If you don't mind." "You kidding? You know that's where I'd love to be if I could. You go right ahead, buddy." "Really, I'll be fine." "Oh, there is no way I would leave you alone. I can stay until Dr. Rosenzweig arrives." Rayford carefully put his hands behind his head and folded his pillow double to prop his head a bit more. From his vantage point, he had a wide view of the heavens, with the moon far to his left and the rest of his field of vision filled with heavy, colorful, moving clouds. As the sky grew darker, the moon seemed brighter, the clouds denser, and the stars clearer. As usual, when his eyes grew accustomed to the night sky, a deeper layer of stars came into view. But as he studied them, they disappeared and he had to search between clouds for more. Chaim arrived with a small entourage, and Rayford was surprised when he dismissed all of them. "I'll call if I need you," he said. And as Abdullah Smith left, Rayford exacted from him a promise that he would call with anything new about Mac or Buck. "Are you sure you want to know?" Abdullah said. "Of course. Don't protect me. Even if it's the worst, we'll reunite with them soon." Chaim settled into a tilting chair next to Rayford's bed and leaned back. "Magnificent," he said. "Like a front row seat to eternity." It wasn't like Chaim to stall. Though past 70 now, he was a brilliant man of seemingly unbridled energy, and no one knew him to waste time. Yet here he sat, studying the skies of Israel, with apparently nothing to say. "Something on your mind, Doctor? I mean, more than 1 million people here would give anything to spend this night with you.
To what do I owe the pleasure?
As global community news media cameras had been trained on the Carpathian cavalry that emerged from the Dung Gate, Mac was relieved to discover he was not nearly the only member getting used to his steed. An equal number of men and women, most representing other sub-potentates, overreacted to their horses and wound up steering them in circles or being nearly chucked off. At first, this was greeted with smiles all around, but it quickly became obvious that Carpathia was no longer amused. He dismissed the press and urged his generals to get everyone to their various means of conveyance to Petra. Mac watched for his opening and was disappointed when his commander chose him as one to accompany Carpathia's cargo plane, big enough for several horses and vehicles. If those in charge only knew that Mac was once Nikolai's chief pilot. Mac had once prided himself on keeping cool in a crisis, particularly when undercover. But as he dismounted and went through the motions of turning his horse over to a swarthy young man in a loud T-shirt who would walk it aboard the plane, he could think of nothing more creative than to simply try to talk his way out of it.
"Say, I've got a problem here, sport," he said. "Yeah? What might that be, sport?" the young man said. "Got myself in the wrong group. Is it too late to catch up with the others?" "You mean the ones being carried by Hummers and such?" "Right." "I don't know, but you'd better try. You get on board this plane when you're not supposed to, and there'll be blood to pay. Anyway, I got no room for even one extra horse."
Mac took the horse back and mounted, and when someone called after him asking what he thought he was doing, he hollered,
"Following orders. Going where they point me."
He looked over his shoulder to confirm that the voice was not that of his commander. He was otherwise engaged, which Mac found comforting. He didn't want to have it out with anybody in the GC this close to the return of Jesus. All he needed was to be arrested or shot just before the end. The animal beneath him seemed to respond to Mac's sense of purpose. Mac knew where he was going now, and he wanted to get there fast. The first thing he wanted to do, once out of anyone else's sight, was to call in the news about Buck and about Carpathia's plans and see if there was any word on Rayford. Then he wanted to get into his own chopper and out of this infernal global community unity army uniform. His own plain and baggy clothes had never seemed so inviting. Sebastian felt the fatigue, not of boredom, but of inactivity. Tension and anticipation would carry him until midnight or even dawn, if necessary. He hoped it wouldn't come to that. He was grateful for the International Co-op and the job Lionel Whalum had been doing with it since Chloe Steele Williams's death. Behind Sebastian stood three gargantuan searchlights, equipment only the co-op could have located and transported. Without the lights, Sebastian's eyes could play tricks on him. In the moonlight alone, he might have imagined the Unity Army beginning to advance again. He sensed the rumble, felt the vibration, knew something was happening, but all he needed was to flip the switches, train those gigantic beams toward the enemy, and determine that they were merely holding their ground half a mile away. Razor's ATV came skidding up behind him in a cloud of dust. Razor approached with a salute and stood at attention.
"You've really got to quit that, boy," Sebastian said. "I'm as military and gung-ho as the next guy, but what am I going to do with you? Court-martial you and put you in the brig for what? An hour or two?"
"Sorry, sir," Razor said, fully reporting on what he called his Captain Steele detail.
"Well, I'm just glad to know it was only you making the ground rumble. Had me thinking the enemy was on the move again."
"Oh, they are, sir."
"They are?"
"Yes, sir. From up on the slopes, I could see them advancing. You can't see them at this level, but they've moved a good bit, sir. They surely have." Sebastian dispatched Otto Vaser to flip the switches on the big lamps. "I'd trust my night vision goggles, but I don't mind the Unity boys seeing what we've got. Anyway, their horses can't be accustomed to this."
Standing by, Big Dog One, Otto called in. Fire 'em up, Sebastian said, and the high beams ripped across the desert sand. Mercy! The enemy had advanced at least 800 yards in the darkness, and the front line of their seemingly endless mounted troops now stood silently about 80 yards away. It was plain they were merely waiting for orders to attack.
We should attack them, sir, Razor said.
Say again?
We should... I heard you, Razor. I just can't believe I heard you. In any other situation, that would be brilliant. Seriously. Sucker punch them, like taking the first swing at the bully. You know they wouldn't be expecting it.
But two things. First, if everything we threw at them found its mark, we cause a mini stampede, kill a few soldiers and horses, then get massacred. Second, we're invulnerable where we stand, as far as we know. We may not be out there.
There is one other thing, Razor said.
I'm listening.
This battle's already been won, and without us lifting a finger.
Well, there is that, yes.
Sebastian's phone chirped. It was Mac.
Yes, George said. Rayford's back in his quarters with Chaim and will apparently pull through. And Buck?
I'm sorry to hear that. You talked to Chang?
Probably monitoring the world. We'll spread the word.
I sense we're a lot alike, Captain Steele, Chaim said.
That drew Rayford's gaze from the window for a second. He couldn't imagine many people he was more different from than Chaim. They were Jew and Gentile, old and not so old, Middle Eastern and American, botanist and aviator, leader of a million people and leader of a small band.
I sense, Chaim said, despite our cultural and professional differences, that we are both normal men thrust into decisions and roles not of our own making. Am I right?
I guess.
It may be even more surprising that I am a believer in Messiah than you are, but both of us took the long way to get here, didn't we?
We did.
As you know, in my current position, I have more company, more friends and associates and elders and advisors than anyone would ever need. True, I had no shortage of options as to with whom I would spend this evening. Frankly, if I could have chosen from the whole universe, I would have chosen your son-in-law. We go back a long, long way. I knew him before he was a believer, and he knew me so long before I was that I dare say he still finds it hard to fathom. My hope is that if Cameron returns tonight, he will join us and feel welcome.
Chang was, in fact, monitoring the world. He had seemed to catch his second wind. He knew he should be in bed, but who could sleep at a time like this? He sat at his computer, staring at the reports coming in from all over the world about people, especially Jews, putting their faith in Jesus Christ as their Messiah. Tens of thousands every few minutes were totaling in the millions now, and Chang had the feeling it wouldn't stop until the glorious appearing. There were to be signs in the heaven before that, and more were prophesied to come to Christ. Rayford and Chaim got the news about Buck from Sebastian a few minutes later. Rayford didn't know what to feel. He knew Buck was fine, better than he had ever been, and that he would see him soon. But he hated the thought that the young man, the father of Rayford's grandson and the husband of his daughter, had suffered so. Rayford had lost many friends and loved ones, none so close as his daughter and now son-in-law. But in the past, he had somehow been able to come to terms with the losses, to tell himself it was the price of war, the inevitable result of what they had been called to do. It was not so easy now, not when it struck so close to home. He called Mac. The clouds parted and the moon shone brightly all the way to the Dead Sea, directly beneath Mac.
I'm not going to lie to you, Ray. Yeah, it looks like Buck came to a rough end. But he was doing what he wanted to do. He worked at it, trained for it. And if you remember the first reports we got from him, he and Zion got done what they hoped to. How's the resistance?
About finished.
Unity's got 'em pushed into the Temple Mount, and it's clear the GC has hardly scratched the surface of their resources yet. They could take the whole city any time they wanted.
You're heading back, I assume.
Not all the way, Max said. I want to see what happens on the Petra perimeter from the air.
Then I want to head back up to Basira and see how that plays out.
You know, I'd give anything to be there with you.
Holy mackerel! You see that, Ray?
I see it. I'll let you go. Time to watch the show.
A cloud had not covered the moon. It was bright and nearly full and had been highlighting the dancing clouds. Suddenly it had seemed to disappear as if someone had turned it out like a light. Rayford knew the moon merely reflected the sun anyway. Thus it was the sun, far below the horizon now, that had lost its light. The sky was pitch. Rayford asked Chaim to douse all the lights.
"We'll see nothing, Captain," Chaim said. "Nonetheless, the better to see what's coming."
Once the lights were off, Rayford could tell Chaim stood by the window only by the sound of his voice. Rayford said, "Have you ever seen blackness so thick?"
"I have seen many wonders in the last 7 years," Chaim said. "This is like seeing nothing. But the mere anticipation it engenders causes a buzz from the top of my head to the soles of my shoes."
Lightning ripped through the sky, and Rayford was stunned to see the clouds briefly again.
"I think I saw a shooting star," he said. "I love those."
"That was more than a shooting star," Chaim said, "which, as you know, is not really a star anyway. What you saw was truly a falling star, maybe a meteor.
Soon stars and meteors will fall, but you will only hear them. Isaiah foretold that the stars of heaven and their constellations would not give their light. The sun will be darkened and the moon will not shine. God is saying, 'I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will halt the arrogance of the proud and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. I will shake the heavens and the earth will move out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts and in the day of his fierce anger. Everyone will flee to his own land. Everyone who is found will be thrust through, and everyone who is captured will fall by the sword.'"
Rayford shook his head. "There's another difference between us, Chaim. I've never been able to memorize like that."
"What else have I to do, Rayford? As I say, I was thrust into this position, and the teacher became the student. My former protege, Dr. Benjuda, would not hear of my giving short shrift to the scriptures. He discipled me, pushed me, grounded me in them. Most of all, God gave me a love for his word. Now there is nothing I would rather do than study it every spare moment and commit as much of it as possible to memory."
Enoch's people leaped to their feet and cried out when the early afternoon sun disappeared from the suburban Chicago sky. Though he knew it was coming, Enoch himself was spooked when the light of day turned into the darkest night and the temperature immediately dropped. He heard a roaring, whistling sound and thought of the cliché that people always used when recounting a tornado. "It sounded like a freight train." Well, this sounded like a plane about to crash. They were close enough to the airport that it could have been, but Enoch had not recalled hearing a jet. Something was coming, and it was getting closer.
"Don't be afraid," Enoch called out,
but he couldn't hide the fear in his own voice.
"This was prophesied. We just talked about it. It's all part of God's plan."
But when whatever was falling finally crashed into the main road on the other side of the mall,
There was no stopping the gathering from bolting to take a look. Enoch jogged along behind them, grateful for the light-sensitive streetlights that began popping on all over. A meteor about 3 feet in diameter had bored a 10-foot-wide hole 20 feet deep in the road. And here came another. People screamed and scattered, but Enoch held his ground. "I believe we're protected," he said. "None of the judgments from heaven harmed God's people. We bear his mark, his seal. He will protect us." But his body of believers had taken flight. Enoch smiled. He would chide them tomorrow when all were unscathed. How strange it seemed to be walking around in midnight darkness early in the afternoon. The next meteorite, which Enoch guessed was twice the size of the first, obliterated one of the former anchor stores in the deserted mall. It caused such an explosion he had to cover his ears. While he truly believed he would not be hurt, he found himself ducking and expecting debris to crack him in the head. Enoch ran back to where he had met with the people, but he was alone now. He sat on a concrete bench and watched the show. Mostly he listened. Had he been a caveman, he would have believed the sky was falling, that the stars would all eventually hit the earth. If anything, the rate of incoming reports of Jewish people turning to the Messiah increased dramatically over the next half hour. Chang beckoned Naomi to his side and sat with his arm around her waist as she stood. They couldn't decide what was more entertaining, the myriad camera feeds from all over the dark world, or the racing meter giving evidence of the fulfilling of the prophecy that a third of the Jewish remnant would come to believe in Jesus as their Messiah by the time of the end. Chang could only think back to the horrific scenes he had monitored when Carpathia was at the height of his murderous fury against the Jews. He had had them rounded up, put in death camps, starved, tortured, beaten, humiliated with psychological warfare, you name it. That any survived was a miracle. That many became believers was something else. "This is sure different from the last time Jesus came," Naomi said. "Besides that we weren't ready, it happened in the twinkling of an eye. Apparently God's going to play this one out for all it's worth." Mac had the strangest sensation. He had been trained to fly by instruments, of course, but still he found it disconcerting to see nothing above. And the only light on the ground was man-produced. Gradually, he picked up boat lights, lights on other planes, headlights of cars and trucks and military vehicles. He heard the scream of falling meteorites over the usually deafening thwack, thwack, thwack of the blades, and even heard the explosions when they blasted the earth. That was new. Mac had never been able to hear anything inside the chopper cockpit, especially with his earphones on. Now, even above the cacophony of GC aviators demanding to know what was going on, the earth resounded with the wrath of God, with the literal falling of the heavens. A meteor at least 10 feet in diameter fell within 100 feet of Mac's helicopter. His lights picked it up, and he followed it until it hit a building, sending a shower of fire and sparks into the air. He had no idea what the building might have been, but it gave him pause. Was he protected from these free-falling monsters of stone or metal? Even a small one would demolish a chopper, and now they began to fall all around him. People on the ground, particularly Unity Army troops, had to be terrified. Mac wondered how many wished they could change their marks of loyalty now. He was fairly certain he would be protected, as believers had been since the judgments began 7 years before, but fairly certain wasn't enough for him to follow through with his plan. Mac made for Petra, knowing that airspace was secure. If he were to die, he could have been killed there many times over, but he had been miraculously spared every time. Rayford was having the time of his life. The news about Buck had set him back, of course, and despite what he knew about the future, it gave him that ache in the pit of his stomach, as had his loss of Chloe. but to lie in his bed watching the heavens shaken as they had been prophesied to do thousands of years before, and to have his old friend Chaim Rosenzweig, the one God had chosen to be a modern-day Moses, standing there quoting those prophecies from memory, well, it almost made him forget his grief and his wounds.
"I saw another angel coming down from heaven," Chaim said, "having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, 'Babylon the Great is fallen, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury.'"
That's what has Carpathia so enraged today, Rayford. It was one thing to lose his beloved city and to see the rest of the kings of the earth and the merchant moguls weeping crocodile tears over her, but to have it rubbed in like this, to have an angel pronounce it, to know that it was the fulfillment of an ancient prophecy by his archenemy, no wonder he is on the rampage now. He has a plan, a scheme he thinks is foolproof, even though he is no fool and has read the book. But he will fail, and we will witness it.
"I so wish I could be out there right now," Rayford said. "Why did this have to happen today, of all days?"
He couldn't see Chaim, but he heard the smile in his voice. "The leader of the tribulation force is not going to start questioning God now, is he? You, of all people, you have been delivered by his hand as many times as I have. You walked through the fire just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego when the GC launched their bombs on Petra, and you're going to whine about having to play inside on a rainy day?" Rayford had to laugh. "Listen to this from the prophet Joel," Chaim said. "I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord."
"I saw that," Rayford said, "when the moon was turned to blood. That was not long before I lost Amanda."
"I know," Chaim said after a pause. "We have all lost so much, and yet so much will be restored. Here's the best part, also from Joel. 'And it shall come to pass that whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem there shall be deliverance, as the Lord has said, among the remnant whom the Lord calls. For behold, in those days and at that time, when I bring back the captives of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. And I will enter into judgment with them there on account of my people, my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations.'" All Rayford could do was grunt. Sometimes scripture had that effect on him. There was nothing more to say, at least not by him. "We are those captives," Chaim said. "My brothers and sisters, the children of Israel."
"Makes me wish I were," Rayford said.
"Oh, you are, of course, by adoption. Gentile believers are his adopted sons and daughters.
But you are all his chosen people.
Not that we have proved worthy. Maybe that's why we are always referred to as the children of Israel."
"What's that reference to the valley of Jehoshaphat?"
"Oh, that is where the judgment will take place, in a valley created by the splitting of the Mount of Olives when he sets foot on it. Jesus himself will judge all men, and prophecy states it will be right there. The Bible says more about him than that he is just the returning king and victorious warrior. It also calls him the judge.
The Gospel of Mark says, "Then they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory." And Revelation says, "Now I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. And he who sat on him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war."
Sebastian stood next to his Hummer with Otto and Razor, straining his eyes to see what he could see. Meteors were raining upon the enemy, and the sounds of panicking soldiers and horses washed over him. Was it possible the hundreds of thousands of steeds could stampede? And what would that do to the plans the Unity Army had for Petra? Vehicles were smashed, exploding into flames and offering the only light to give him a clue how far back the front lines had been driven. It seemed they were still virtually atop him, but Sebastian had to know.
Chapter 8. "Do we know the timing?" Rayford said. "I know we know what comes next, but do we know when?"
"We never have," Chaim said. "I was one who thought the glorious appearing would be exactly 7 years from the signing of the covenant between Antichrist and Israel, but clearly we were wrong about that. We know that following the phenomena in the sky comes the sign of his coming, but nothing tells us whether that will be immediate. God has his own timetable."
"A 1,000 years is as a day and all that," Rayford said.
"And vice versa."
The booming of the meteorites shook Rayford's little shelter, and as they increased in frequency, his bed moved. He felt every injury. The anesthetic in his temple had long since worn off, and the pain pierced and throbbed. His chin bothered him, too, though he had considered that the least of his wounds. Every nick and scrape and gash was sensitive, and the aching ankle, which had caused his foot to swell, made his muscles tense. He felt it in both legs, all the way to his hip. Rayford spread his pillow flat and laid his head back, stretching. He had no idea what was keeping him awake. On the other hand, of course he did. Mac overflew Busaira, where he saw little but scattered lights on the ground, and was soon at the edge of Petra. He checked in with Chang to let him know he would be putting down. The last thing he wanted was to be mistaken for enemy aircraft and be fired upon by Big Dog One and his own people. Would God protect him even from them?
"Hey," Mac shouted into the phone. "What's that? What's Sebastian doing?"
"Using his big torches to light up the sky," Chang said. "He wants to know how much damage the meteorites are doing to the Unity Army."
"Looks like he's more fascinated with the clouds."
"So am I."
"I hear you, Chang. Me too. If you're in touch with Sebastian, tell him to leave those babies pointing straight up."
Sebastian wouldn't have dreamed of doing anything else. The searchlights had the enemy looking up, too. The clouds blanketed the entire sky, bubbling and roiling and joining one another to form a ceiling unlike anything anyone had ever seen. Far in the distance, Sebastian heard the low rumble of long echoing explosions and finally deduced it was thunder. Did that mean lightning was striking somewhere? Or was it just streaking through the heavens among the clouds? "Cut the lights a minute," he radioed, eliminating the possibility that they would cost him a view of the lightning. Sure enough, above the clouds, and who knew how thick they were, tiny pulsating bursts of light seemed to try to peek through. Suddenly, the artificial light lost its allure. If a storm was coming his way, Sebastian wanted to see it in all its natural glory. Mac landed and hurried to Rayford's quarters, surprised to find them dark as midnight. He considered refueling and heading out again. Regardless of Rayford's view, if he was here after all, nothing would compare with watching from overhead when the Antichrist got his due. He knocked lightly.
Anybody in here?
Mac, he heard. It was Rayford, but Chaim greeted him when the door opened. After embraces all around in the dark and a quick retelling of both men's day, Rayford told Mac there was another chair in the other room. Feeling about, Mac noisily banged his way back with it and sat himself in front of the window.
Nice show, he said, but you ought to see it from a chopper.
You're breaking my heart, Rayford said.
Sorry.
No, I want every detail. You going back out?
Thinking about it, partner. Seems risky.
I'd think you'd be throwing caution to the wind at this point.
I want to be alive when it happens, Ray. That's all.
I'll bet old Chaim here would even be tempted to go with you once the sign appears in the sky.
Oh, no, gentlemen, Chaim said, chuckling. My place is here. I want the entire remnant out in the high places watching for the return. We must all be in place, singing, praying, ready to worship him in spirit and in truth, and best of all, in person.
I've at least got to be there, Rayford said.